Well, I'm thinking about like, think about like ants. And you look at that and you might be able to say, well, maybe we should ascribe mental states to ants because doing so enables us to explain and predict their behavior. You know, why are they building these complex structures? Well, it's because they have desires to, or they want to please the queen or something. And then people come, you know, the biologists come around and like, no, they're automaton or something. So I think that, yeah, if I were an ant, I think it'd be more justified for me to be like, of course, Steve, the other ant, has a mental state like mine. We're of the same kind, but he might be in a better position as an ant than I am, you know, making all the proper adjustments there.
I see. So, well, if you were an ant, I guess you would know whether you were conscious.
Right.
And then, like, you hear some biologists saying, ants are not conscious.
Right.
Then you would just know that he's wrong.
Totally. Right. And it's the same thing with us, where we have, you know, illusionists or someone being like, yeah, consciousness is illusion. It's like, well, you're wrong because I'm, you know, but the alien observing the illusionist philosophy talk might be like, it looks like they are conscious to me, but this dude's saying that they're not, and I'm not of the same kind as them. So maybe I'm not in as good of a position as the audience is. Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is very, very special. I have someone who hasn't been on very much, Mike Humer. Just kidding. He's been on a bunch, and we were joking that we're going to have to change the name to Parker and Mike's Pensies because he's been on so much. It's not my fault. He's so good at everything that we could have him on every other episode, and I plan on it. You know, we keep getting him on. He is a huge broad scope that he publishes in, so not just thinks about, but like publishes papers in. So today we're going to be talking about the problem of other minds, which is one of my favorite puzzles in philosophy. How do you know that I have a mind? Yeah, I look like you maybe, but like, how are you justified in that belief? How do you know that I have a mind like you? You have different evidence than I have direct awareness of my mental states. I don't have them of yours. So that's what we're going to talk about. And we're going to get into some AI stuff too. Like, how could we ever know that an artificial intelligence, you know, is intelligent or is conscious, or how would we even know that? So we're going to get into that. I'm really excited for it. Before we jump in, if you guys like this podcast, if it's your top five, if somewhere in your top five, then please consider becoming a Patreon patron or joining my YouTube members. I now have exclusive content for you guys as well that I will only be sharing there. So you can go and find two videos on apologetics there. You can find a bunch of other perks, a bunch of merch and stuff over there too. So click the link in the description wherever you're getting this podcast at, and please help me keep the lights on. Help me keep luring Dr. Mike Humer back on and help me feed my puppies. That's probably enough. Let's jump in with Dr. Humer on the problem of other minds. Dr. Humer, thanks so much for coming back on again.
Yes, thanks for having me and the generous introduction.
I always think about, I mean, we've talked about this before, but I always think about, you were at a philosophy conference and the introducer was the announcer, whoever was talking about, was trying to describe you, and they're like, this is Mike Humer and he does philosophy generally construed.
Yeah, that's so my AOS.
That's awesome. So this one's another fun one because we're going to talk about the mind. You have this paper, Dualism and the Problem of Other Minds. I didn't, you know, you sent me a Word document, so I didn't see like the reference. Where's this going to be published at? Where's this coming
through? So this is for Oxford Studies in Philosophy of Mind. Nice. It was invited by Uriah Kriegel.
That's so good. So since you have such a broad scope, like, why think of Mike Humer for the problem of other minds? Is that because you've done a book on like paradoxes and stuff? I don't know if you have a book on the philosophy of mind yet.
No, I don't. It's you know, one of the remaining gaps in my publication list. I've got to get to that next. Well, he wanted to do a volume with issues at the intersection of epistemology and philosophy of mind. Okay. So he's a philosopher of mind. And I guess he thought, you know, Humer could do something at this intersection. So I thought, well, you know, I have an idea about other minds. So, which I thought of when I was an undergraduate, you know, for my senior thesis, which I wrote for John Searle.
So there's something there. Yeah.
It's like a, you know, yeah, like a 30-year-old thesis or something, which I can still find. I thought I lost it, but then I found it on old compact discs.
That's hilarious. Does it still stand up? Like, is that where you developed this paper off of your thesis?
Yeah, it's the same argument.
Nice.
I think, you know, I think I've become more scholarly a little bit.
That's good to hear. Oh man, that's awesome. Well, yeah, can you lay it out for us? What for those who aren't familiar, what is the problem of other minds?
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the short version is, how do you know that other people are conscious and not just mindless automata?
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, in setting this up, usually you make a point about how you can't actually observe people's mental states. You can only observe their physical behavior. And so it's logically possible that that behavior would be caused by purely physical causes without any mental states. Yeah. Right. Which, you know, like maybe that's what happened when you have computers that are trying to simulate human-like thoughts or something.
Yeah.
So, and you think, okay, so, and you wonder about how you could know about that. And then you think, well, maybe there's like some kind of inductive argument or something. Like, you know, I look at what physical states cause my mental state, and then I see those physical states happen to another person. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, so maybe that'll cause the same mental states in them. You know, but then that seems like a really weak argument, you know, because you only have one person that you've observed the mental states of.
Yeah, it's an inductive argument from a single case, which is not the best to use.
It seems like, as a matter of fact, the worst inductive argument that actually counts as inductive at all.
Yeah.
You know, and then like some people say, oh, no, it's not really from one case, because you can observe many occasions on which you have mental states of a particular kind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's many cases in some sense, right? Okay, but you know, you think like, well, I mean, what if I was a medical researcher and I was making inferences like this, right? Like I had a medical treatment and I tried it on me and it worked. And I have only ever tried on me, but don't worry, like I tried it on me 10 times, right? Like I got a cold 10 times and I tried this remedy. Like, can I now say, yeah, it's almost certainly working on everyone. No.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Okay, so the move there, yeah, you start with yourself. I love this problem because I think at first it's like, well, for the uninitiated, it seems silly. It's like, well, yeah, of course other people have minds. You go, well, how do you know? You know, how do you know that? Because think about how you know that you have a mind, and then you don't get to use that evidence for me. Just like you're saying here. And then it starts to mess with people and you think, well, maybe I live in a computer simulation. Maybe I'm just, you know, maybe I'm a solipsist and nothing really exists. Which is,
I should say, like, I don't take the problem to be to figure out whether there are other minds.
Okay.
That is, I take it that we all believe that there are other minds and that we know it.
Yeah.
And so then there's just like a puzzle to explain how we know it. Right. Like, so, you know, we could go through some different accounts of how you would know it, and then like see how they face difficulties, right? And you're trying to figure out what the best account is, but you know, it's pretty puzzling.
Yeah, yeah. You make that point that this isn't like a skeptical worry, or it can be, but you're not treating it that way. And it's not like the psychological or developmental question of like, when does a child think that other people have minds? But it's like, no, we have this. So, would you say your approach like a particularist approach, saying we obviously know there are other minds, so now how do we go about explaining that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this fits with the rest of my sort of common sense philosophy, right? Like, if there's something that's completely obvious, then, you know, it's not on the table to say that that thing isn't the case, right? Yeah. Let's just figure out why it's the case.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the level of certainty that I have that there are other minds is extremely high.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, any other normal person, right? Like, you treat that hypothesis, of no other minds the same way like you would treat the brain in a vat scenario, which is to say you get to completely dismiss it in normal context.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, you know, like one of the problems with the argument from analogy is like it seems to only give you like a slight probability or something like that. Like, oh yeah, it's kind of plausible that maybe there are other minds. It doesn't explain why. It's just like not even a reasonable alternative to consider that they're mindless automata.
Right. Yeah. 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 It kind of legitimizes the question by trying to treat it on its own terms, but doing so with like super slight evidence.
Yeah.
That's
that, you know, that happens with a lot of philosophical responses to skepticism, I would say, or at least some, you know, you're like, oh, yeah, the brain of that scenario, oh, it's just too complex.
Like, yeah. And so like, no, we know this. Yeah.
Even if that was true, right? Like that only makes it slightly worse than the real world.
Yeah. I guess with the common sense answers, some might be easier than others. Like Moore's proof is like, here's a hand, here's another one, but it might be a little bit different. Like here's a mind and here's another one. And it's like, well, where is this mind?
Yeah. I think, well, I guess, yeah. What's the Moorean version of this? Like, well, Parker has a mind, obviously. So therefore there are other minds.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Oh man. Okay, so that's the argument from analogy, and it's an inductive, it's induction from a single case, so it's not super great. You also mentioned this perceptual theory that we can directly observe facts about mental states of others. Why would anyone go in for this?
Yeah, you know, it's like weird at first glance, right? You saw the anger. Wait, how do you see somebody's anger? What color is anger? It's like, well, you know, the idea is like, okay, a person makes a certain expression on their face and then you could just see that they're angry. Hmm. Like, okay, does that count as actually observed or is that inferred? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like actually most of the things that you say that you observe, there's a certain amount of unconscious information processing that has to go on. Yeah. So like you say you saw that there was a cat on a mat, but some kind of information processing had to go on in your brain for you to recognize the cat as a cat and the thing as a mat. And like, and even like, you're like to recognize lines or so anyway, right? Yeah. So, but you didn't consciously infer that. Like when you looked, it just looked like, you know, consciously it was just like an experience of, oh, obviously there's a cat on the mat. Okay. But the thought is, well, I mean, seeing other people's emotional states is kind of like that. You don't consciously figure out. Like you're not aware of going through any reasoning process to get to that person was angry. Rather, it's just like, it just immediately strikes you that they're angry.
Yeah.
Okay. So, right. So, you know, you might think, okay, am I, well, okay. So just perceiving that P in general typically involves unconscious information processing. Okay.
Yeah.
So does it involve reasoning? Like as in, you know, when you go through a proof and you actually reason. So it seems like, well, it doesn't.
Right.
Well, you might say, oh, maybe I'm unconsciously reasoning. And then you might want to kind of draw a distinction between unconscious reasoning and non-conscious information processing that doesn't even count as unconscious reasoning.
Yeah.
Okay. Like you might want to say, oh, when you see the cat on the mat, that's like not even unconscious reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Okay, I don't know. Maybe it's because it's subpersonal. So the processing is being done by mechanisms in your brain that are not people. So,
yeah.
And that are not in principle able to be conscious. Okay. And then, and you know, you think of things like, well, I would not myself be able to identify the premises of the inference that I'm supposedly making, right?
Yeah.
If you want to say that I'm unconsciously making inferences. So like a lot of the stuff that goes on when you perceive the world, you wouldn't be able to identify how the processing works. You wouldn't be able to identify the premises. And even if somebody told you the premises, you wouldn't recognize them, right? So
yeah,
like when if I recognize your voice, I can't articulate the properties of your voice that enables me to recognize it as you specifically.
Oh, that's a good point. Well, so, sorry to break the line of thought here, but I'm wondering if it is unconscious or if it's subpersonal information processing, you can't identify the premises and stuff going on, would that count as being like rationally justified? Because it's, I mean, maybe this has to do with externalism and internalism, but it's still, even for the externalist, it seems like, I guess the externalist would say, well, it depends on the case. Depends on if you're in the good case or bad case. But like, yeah. why trust those processes if you have no access to what's going on?
Yeah, you know? I mean, well, this depends on your theory of the justification of perceptual beliefs. But if you have a good theory of perceptual knowledge, it should cover things like seeing a cat on the mat and like me recognizing a particular person's voice whom I know.
Yeah.
And like, you know, pick up the phone and you don't see the person, but you recognize their voice. Okay. And they don't have to say who they are. So like, you know, a good theory of perception should count that as knowledge. And if it does, then it's probably going to count this thing where I see that you're angry as knowledge.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So, again, this doesn't have to do with it, but I'm just curious because you do know epistemology pretty well. When it comes to like unconscious inferences and subpersonal information processing, is there like a naive realist approach to perception where it's like, no, this isn't going on. I'm just directly acquainted with the cat on the mat, and there is no processes going on? Or does that seem like way too naive?
That sounds too naive. So, okay. I mean, like, I think the direct realist view that some people like me hold would say, yeah, you count as being directly aware of the cat on the mat and maybe even directly aware of the fact that there's a cat on the mat.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean that there's not processing going on in your brain, because we know there is. You know, but like, I don't know, there are these cognitive science people who are studying it. Like, I assume that they know.
Yeah.
They're not just making stuff up.
But is, I guess, is it mediated through like concepts and stuff that have to be processed in order for you to see the cat on the mat?
Maybe. Okay. I mean, so yeah, it looks like there are some experiences that you can't have unless you have a certain concept. So
yeah.
You know, the famous duck rabbit picture where,
Yeah,
it looks like a duck, but it also kind of looks like a rabbit. Okay. If you don't have the concept of a duck, like you've never encountered ducks before, then you can't see the duck aspect and you don't know what people are talking about. Like if somebody says, hey, you know, what's this? You go picture of a rabbit and they're like, well, you could see it as another animal. Try. You will not be able to see it as the other animal. So anyway, and it's not a matter of belief, right? When you switch between seeing the two aspects of the picture, you're not changing your beliefs. It's like, you know that nothing has changed about the picture. You don't think that it changed.
Yeah, unless you go in for some woo-woo stuff about, I don't know, quantum physics, and you're creating a collapse of the wave function or something, but maybe we can just...
Yeah,
put those to one side.
But so I mean, concepts are involved in some way.
Okay.
But you're not like consciously reasoning or anything.
Yeah. Okay. And this was totally peripheral, and it was just a random question, but it doesn't have to do with your argument here. You go in with, you give names to these people, which is fun. Reza, the reasoner, and Percy, the perceiver. And Reza has unconscious inference going on, and Percy has subpersonal information processing going on. And then you make this parody. I'm a little unclear on the distinction between the two. So I'm sure a lot of my audience is too. Like, what would be the difference between unconscious inferences and making them and subpersonal information processing?
So, you know, just like for like why this matters to the problem of other minds, you know, like, well, it's supposed to have something to do with how the person is justified. All right. So if you reasoned to the conclusion that another person has a certain mental state, then it looks like, oh, you've got to have justification for the premises, whatever. And like the reasoning form has to be cogent or something. And then the people who are claiming that your knowledge is perceptual, they want to avoid having to, you know, you having to find justification for the premises and whatever. Yeah. So they want to say, okay, so you didn't reason to it, not even unconsciously. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, but something happened. So, well, yes, but it was just this subpersonal information processing, yeah. right? Like happens in your brain all the time, even when you see normal things, right? So, yeah. okay. So like that's supposed to help epistemologically, right? Okay, well, I don't know. What would the difference be between me making an unconscious inference and me going through some, like my brain doing information processing that doesn't even count as inference? Okay, well, so one difference would be like what's my attitude towards the information that is used to reach the conclusion, right? Which would be called the premises if it's an inference.
Yeah.
So if it's an inference, then... if it's an unconscious inference, then if you ask me about the premises, they should be things that I would believe.
Oh, right? Yeah, that makes sense. So even if you don't have direct access to them, I could prompt you by saying, is this the first premise that you were, and you go, oh, yeah, that seems like the first one.
Does that? I mean, I may not even, well, whether or not I identified that that was actually what I was using, should accept it as true.
Gotcha. Right? Yeah, that makes sense.
Like, yeah. You know, you like you give the information, go, is that the case? I should go, yeah, that's the case, okay. obviously. Right. And also if you asked, okay, so this information, you know, these premises, do they support C, you know, this conclusion? And it should seem like they do.
Yeah.
And like for it to be an unconscious inference, right? So like I don't have to have thought it at the time, but it should be a thing that I would regard as an acceptable inference.
Yeah.
But this isn't the case in, you know, like in many cases, you know, where your brain is doing processing, right? So like if somebody gave me the voice print description, like the description of your voice print, like yeah. whatever it is, and then said, so is that what Parker's voice sounds like? I would go, I don't know. Right.
Yeah, that's so good.
And, you know, hey, if a voice has these properties, does that cogently support that it's Parker? I don't know.
That's almost like another Mary's Room type argument, right? You could have like the printout of my whole, you could have all the physical facts about my voice, but you wouldn't know because it's something different. That it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing is, I guess like it's a description, but you sort of like can't put together what it sounds like.
Yeah.
But there's a, like, I mean, I have in mind, you're imagining the description does describe phenomenal properties, but it would be like, it would be this complicated description and you probably haven't reflected on.
Yeah.
Like, so, you know, it would be hard to say whether that's actually the properties that you experience when you hear this person.
Oh yeah. Good call. Yeah. Okay. So, getting back to the problem. So why is Reza and Percy, like, how does that, tell against the perceptual theory?
Yeah, so you imagine two people, and one of them, by stipulation, is unconsciously reasoning to a conclusion about other minds. You know, like, some, Reza sees somebody who's angry. Is Reza a male or female name? I forgot.
I knew a Reza who was a dude when I was young.
All right, yeah. Sees a person's expression and he unconsciously reasons to the conclusion that the person's angry. And then Percy sees the same expression and doesn't unconsciously reason, but his brain does subpersonal information processing and gives him the same conclusion, the person is angry.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so there's a question of whether Percy has an epistemological advantage, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what these perceptual theorists about other minds are trying to say, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so what is the, what's the descriptive difference between Reza and Percy? It's something like, well, if you ask Percy, if you give both of them this description of the face, like, okay, so these muscles were contracted, and like the mouth was slightly downturned, and there was like the eyebrows were slightly put together or something like, given that complicated description. If you asked Reza, he would say, yes, that was what the face looked like. And you ask him, and does that support that the person's angry? Reza would go, yes, it does. Okay. And then Percy would go, I don't know if that's what the face looked like. And I don't know if that supports that they're angry. Okay. Now, does that mean that Percy has an epistemologically better position?
Hmm.
So it's like, okay, so Percy, that is in fact the information from which he came to the belief, his brain came to the belief. but he doesn't know whether that actually supports the belief. Does that put him in a better position?
Doesn't look like it. Yeah. Like,
no.
Yeah. Okay. So, and that would be the perceptual theory. Percy is the perceiver. And so it looks like subpersonal information processing doesn't get us to a better position to say, to justify our belief in other minds. I wonder, so maybe I have in mind the more skeptical worry because of your former epistemology professor, Barry Stroud. But I'm thinking about like Hillary Putnam's super actors and super Spartans in his paper, Brains and Behavior. And he says like, well, we can imagine that there's these super actors who give off the wrong facial expressions. You know, there's nothing going on. They're acting and they're doing it so well that maybe they can even control their, neurophysiology. So even if you had brain scans going, or super Spartans who are so tough that they don't have, like, they're not going to perspire even when someone's like drilling in their foot or something like that. Something horrible. Does that come into play, or would both Reza and Percy, both the unconscious inference and subpersonal, is there just room for them being mistaken? And they say, hey, look, you know, that doesn't really have to do with this.
Yeah. I mean, they would both be subject to the same possibility of error. Right.
So,
I guess like Reza would be in a better position to recognize the possibilities of error because,
So that's just a better theory in general. Like Reza's unconscious inferences seem like it's just a more justified take if you're doing things that way, right?
Well, is he more likely to have justified beliefs? I don't know. I mean, because like I take it that the differences turn on these things like, well, would you accept, like if somebody gave you the correct description of what the person's face looks like or whatever, would you accept it as being true? So, like, does that theory have an advantage? Well, it depends whether you think it's plausible that a person would. And I think, no, there's just a lot of stuff where you just don't know how you recognize something. I mean, there are some cases where you do know, like, okay, so like, you know, I offered somebody $1,000 for their car and they said no. And I go, well, why not? And they're like, well, because I think it's worth like $5,000, asshole. And then I think I know why I believe that. Yeah. I think I know why the person rejected my offer.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't think that I had to unconsciously infer. I think I consciously infer.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's good. So we have, we're just knocking these down. We got the argument from analogy. It looks like it's, you know, insufficient because it's induction from a single case. Perceptual theory looks like it's not a better explanation than like unconscious inference. There's this parity and there's supposed to be doing more work and it looks like it's not able to do that. And then you have I think your preferred method is IBE, inference to the best explanation, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, basically, well, our beliefs about other people's minds explain their behavior. And it explains very complex and ordered behavior that would be extremely difficult to explain without using mental concepts.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, you think about something like, okay, so I hold a class, you know, on Monday and Wednesday throughout the semester, and a bunch of students show up every time. And like, okay, so now, you know, imagine somebody who doesn't have any mental concepts explaining what's going on. So there are these particular bits of matter that keep winding up here, but it's like, and there's like a cycle of 7 rotations of the earth where, you know, like they show up here. And then after 2 rotations of the earth, they show up again. And then after another 5 rotations, they show up again. Yeah. And it's in this particular location, right? And you're like, what's making all these blobs show up here? Like, just like it's incredibly difficult to explain that. And you're like, okay, well, maybe there's just like some unknown physical mechanism that happens to have that effect. Like, I don't know. That's like a super complicated mechanism. And like, it's super unlikely. You're like, okay, so, well, for almost any mechanism that would have that result, it would be like easily disrupted.
Yeah.
Okay. So like, what is enabling the blobs to come back after 2 rotations of the sun? Like, well, it's got to be two rotations of the Earth. It's got to be that they're detecting the cycles of light and dark. Hmm. Okay, so like, you know, if we block the sun so that they can't see the sun, they're not going to come back, right?
Yeah.
Like, no, not true, right? Yeah. And, okay, and you know, just like, and the fact that there's like 30 of them that are showing up, right? And then like, you know, one time I send out an email that says, okay, class is canceled. And like, and then none of them show up.
Yeah.
Or like maybe one of them shows up because he didn't get the email. But like, okay, how do you explain what's going on without using mental concepts, right? Like, yeah, without saying that they believe that the class was canceled or something. Mm-hmm. Like, you're just not going to be able to explain the pattern of when they go and when they don't go and all this stuff.
Yeah. So again, I like that you keep using all these names. You have Alan the alien, and he comes to Earth and does what you were just describing. I wonder, in the case of Alan, though, Alan isn't the same kind as the humans he's observing. And so I wonder if that would put him in a different, like, epistemological situation, where it's like, I'm more justified, or it's more reasonable for me to make claims about, or for you to make claims about your students because you take them to be of the same kind as you, than it would be for Alan, who is just observing. What do you make of that? Do you think that's right?
Well, so like if there was an intelligent alien species, they would probably find it harder to understand our behavior than we do.
Yeah.
Because they would probably have different mental states. Sure. So there might be some emotions that they don't have, or there might be some emotions that they have that we don't. Yeah. And then like when we're acting on one of those emotions, they might not understand what we were doing, mm-hmm, because they don't know what it feels like. No, I mean, would they have less justification for believing that we're conscious in general? Well, probably not, right? Mm. Not noticeably less.
Well, I'm thinking about like ants, and you look at that and you might be able to say, well, maybe we should ascribe mental states to ants because doing so enables us to explain and predict their behavior. You know, why are they building these complex structures? Well, it's because they have desires to, or they want to please the queen or something. And then people come, you know, the biologists come around and like, no, they're automaton or something. So I think that, yeah, if I were an ant, I think it'd be more justified for me to be like, of course, Steve, the other ant, has a mental state like mine. We're of the same kind, but he might be in a better position as an ant than I am. making all the proper adjustments there.
I see. So, well, if you were an ant, I guess you would know whether you were conscious.
Right.
And then like you hear some biologists saying ants are not conscious.
Right.
Then you would just know that he's wrong.
Totally. And right. Then, and I guess, it's the same thing with us, where we have, you know, illusionists or someone being like, yeah, consciousness is illusion. It's like, well, you're wrong because I'm, but the alien observing the illusionist philosophy talk might be like, I looks like they are conscious to me, but this dude's saying that they're not, and I'm not of the same kind as them. Mm. So maybe I'm not as good of a position as the audience is.
Yeah. So I guess, I guess the question is sort of about whether argument from analogy plays some role.
Yeah.
And I'm not against it playing any role at all. I'm just being sufficient by itself. So
yeah, you mentioned that. Yeah. Like, so I'm just wondering, does it, okay. So let's say that there's an inference to the best explanation. And then for the alien, Alan, the alien has an IBE for us being conscious. But I have IBE plus analogy because I am same kind as you. Am I more justified than Alan, you think?
Oh, yeah. So I guess you're a little bit more justified, right? Yeah,
cool.
But only a little
more
bit.
Evidence. Yeah.
Because I think he's got like very high justification. Yeah. Just, you know, like human behavior is so complex. Now, if it comes to ants, like I think there could be like a real uncertainty about whether they have any mental states.
Right.
Like their behavior it's simple enough that it could be a mechanism. And I mean, anything could just be a mechanism, but it's like it's less improbable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think about the disanalogy. I think about like Sophia the robot, and I forgot who did it now. It's not Hanson. It might be Hanson. Is it Hanson Robotics?
I'm not sure.
I think it might be. Ben Gerzel is coming on to talk about it. So he'll correct the thing, the record. But, you know, Sophia has all these complex facial emotions and stuff, and they mimic the human. And so if you're looking at it, it's like, oh yeah, it looks like she's upset, but I guess we say that she's not because we have other like theoretical things that are coming into play where like, no, she's a robot. Yes. And I don't think robots can be conscious or something. Is.
Yeah. I mean, I can explain why it's making those expressions.
Oh yeah.
And my explanation doesn't involve attributing mental states to the robot.
Yeah.
My explanation involves attributing mental states to the makers of the robot. Mm-hmm. And particularly the makers of the robot deliberately.
Yeah.
Tried to make it make expressions that look like a person who has that mental state.
Yeah.
Because they identify the expressions that a person makes when they have an emotion, and then they intentionally create a mechanism that would make those. And so like that's an explanation that doesn't require attributing mental states to the robot.
Yeah. No, that's so good. Okay. Yeah. So that's a way to block the inference to the best explanation using it for a supposedly conscious machine. No, that's good. Okay. How would we ever know about the ants? Do you think that there's like a test that we could do?
Well, not that I know of. I'm like, if there was just a behavioral test that you could do, somebody would have done it because, you know, they're clever people.
Sure.
but basically we need a better theory of consciousness.
Yeah.
That is like, we need a theory that explains what causes consciousness in the first place.
Mm.
And then we could see whether ants have it, right?
Yeah.
So it could be like, oh, you know, there's like the integrated information theory of consciousness, right? So, okay. So if we became convinced that was true, then we could sort of like calculate the integrated information score of the ant, right?
Yeah.
Actually, I guess on this theory, they are conscious because like just anything is a little bit conscious or something.
Yeah, information goes deep. Yeah. Yeah, that's fascinating. Or yeah, if you had like global workspace or something, and you're like, well, it doesn't look like there's any global workspace going on in the ant. So yeah, it would just be a theoretical way. Unless, what do you think about like what about like mental sharing and like Neuralink or anything? You're a substance dualist, so I think that you'd probably be like, no. But do you think that it's like possible metaphysically to go in for like mental sharing where I could experience your, maybe even experience your qualia as Parker, you know, maybe I'm not experiencing it as Mike Humor, but.
Yeah. Still. I mean, you can't experience my token mental states, but you could experience a qualitative duplicate of my mental state.
Yeah.
You know, like. Well, no, you just like have to get your brain into the same configuration.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And because we're both humans, it's plausible that you could.
Yeah. But so that wouldn't be something we could do with an ant because we have radically different like wetware and stuff.
I mean, my knowledge of ant brains is limited, but I know that they're a lot smaller.
Yeah.
So, right. So like, it's probably not possible to instantiate most of the mental states that we have. In something that small.
Yeah, that's good. Well, do you think that there are theories of mind that exacerbate the problem of other minds more than others?
Yeah. I mean, there are theories that make it insoluble, right? And or basically entail that we don't have knowledge of other minds.
Yeah.
But this is commonly ignored. The people who have these theories commonly don't notice this. But, you know, this is like an example of how philosophers have crazy theories that, you know, they couldn't really believe. But anyway... But they sort of believe it, like they believe it at an explicit conscious verbal level, but unconsciously they believe the opposite. Anyway, so
yeah,
say you're an epiphenomenalist, you know, like so your view is mental states don't affect the physical world at all.
Mm-hmm.
So then on that view, if other people didn't have mental states, they would behave in exactly the same way. Like that's an explicit prediction of your theory. So like your theory implies that your belief doesn't track the truth.
Yeah.
You know, like, and it doesn't explain anything, right? Your theory implies that your beliefs about other minds don't explain anything about people's behavior, which is what you can actually observe. So
yeah,
the theory seems to imply that your own views are unjustified, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Jim Slagle has written a whole book called The Epistemological Skyhook, where he goes in on like self-defeat type arguments. And this is a big one that it looks like the epiphenomenalists who poo-poo like folk psychology, people who are like, yeah, I have mental states. It looks like they have to, in a sense, presuppose folk psychology in order to make their arguments against folk psychology. And that is a reason to reject a view that rejects folk psychology. Which I'm is not really sure if
this is what you mean, but I guess like, you know, when you're forming your beliefs about the brain or whatever, well, you're taking them mostly on testimony, right? You have to use a lot of testimony. So that means you have to use your beliefs about other people's minds.
Yeah.
You have to believe that the person who said something about the brain said it because they believed it.
Right.
And they had good reasons or something like that.
So. Right. And then even going further, like you have your beliefs and you're saying that you're coming to these beliefs for reasons and for other beliefs, right? So other people's beliefs, maybe even your own, but then you think that they're not like they don't play a causal role in you forming beliefs, but you just said they did, you know? So, yeah. So epiphenomenalism. Yeah. That's so fascinating. Cause then it's like, well, everyone else could be a philosophical zombie because you think that philosophical zombies are possible because like the mental states, it's just like epi, it's just up there. It doesn't do any causal. So it would act exactly the same way without any mentality. So yeah, I wonder like why even think that anyone else does have mentality then? You do, I guess, but kind
of. Basically it's like initially you would explain people's behavior by appealing to their mental states.
Yeah.
But, you know, then you become an epiphenomenalist and like, allegedly, you've got great evidence that there is an alternative explanation. Now, you don't actually know the alternative explanation, i.e. you don't know the precise brain state that the person is in, right, such that you could predict their behavior from the brain state. But your theory says that there is a complete physical explanation that doesn't appeal to their mental states.
Right.
And I think that alone, that's a defeater for your beliefs about the mental states. So,
yeah.
Now you have to give up the beliefs about the mental states, right?
That's right. That's so good. I love that. do you think that there are psychophysical laws that, I mean, maybe you don't have, I don't think you have to believe that there are psychophysical laws like Donald Davidson. Yeah. I don't think believe there was, maybe Richard Swinburne, but, yeah. What do you think? Yeah. Do you think that there are psychophysical laws that allow our mind and brain to interact with each other?
Oh, I mean, I guess, right. I mean, there's psychophysical causation.
Yeah.
So I guess it's governed by laws.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. I guess that's not like logically required, but
right.
As far as we know, other cases of causation are governed by laws. So I guess this is.
Yeah. No, that's good. I'm setting something up later about the AI stuff. So I wanted to see if that was there. So you do go through like kind of a whole gambit of the philosophy of mind. We talk about epiphenomenalism, but you also talk about mind-brain identity theory. So the title of the paper is Dualism and the Problem of Other Minds. And it's,
yeah.
I don't know if you're using the IBE to say like, look, dualism best explains that we can infer to the best explanations. Is this an argument for dualism? Because you are kind of running ship on all the other views except for dualism.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. It's an argument for dualism, right? Like, so, you know, when you think about the best answer to the problem of other minds, you realize that it presupposes dualism or something like that.
Yeah. That's great.
So the mind-brain identity theory. Okay, so you think that mental states just are brain states. And then, well, that's kind of like epiphenomenalism, right? Now, officially, it's not epiphenomenalism because the mental states just are brain states and the brain states are causally efficacious. Therefore, the mental states are causally efficacious. Okay.
Right.
But on this theory, the fact that you have mental states, that doesn't add any explanatory power, right? So like if somebody considers the hypothesis where other people have the brain states that they have, but those just don't constitute mental states.
Yeah.
That person should predict exactly the same behavior as the person who thinks the brain states do constitute mental states.
Right.
Okay. And the idea that other people's brain states constitute mental states, you know, like that's like, so, you know, the core of the mind-brain identity theory. Well, that idea doesn't explain anything, right? You could say, other people just have brain states explaining their behavior and they don't constitute mental states, right? In general, like when, so like other people's mental states are a theoretical posit from your point of view.
Right.
And to justify the theoretical posit, you have to show how it explains something that wouldn't be explained if you don't adopt that theory.
But you can't do that because your whole theory, the explanation is on the physical states.
Yeah.
So good. Yeah, I was trying to think of an analogy, but it's kind of tricky sometimes. I don't know, if you painted like one side of a penny green on all the pennies, and you're looking at the green ones and you're like, look at all these mental states, but you look underneath and they're all copper, and that's really what's doing all the work. it's not the color doing anything, it's like the physical properties of the penny that are knocking into each other or something and finally knock over the last one. So it the color is just kind of there, but it doesn't, it's, who cares? It could have been any color. It doesn't really matter. I don't know if that's a good analogy. Probably not.
Yeah, I'm a little confused. Sorry. Okay, but you know, like, okay, take examples of real theoretical identities like water's H2O. Okay.
Yeah, there we go.
And now imagine somebody telling you why they're justified in believing that. And they go like, okay, well, you know, my theory about water, like H2O explains some stuff. Oh, what does it explain? Well, like there's a water stain on my coffee table. Oh, how does H2O explain that? Well, you see, I spilled some water there, and water is H2O, and water caused the water stain on the table. Therefore, H2O caused the water stain on the table. Therefore, my theory that there's H2O helps explain my observation of this water stain on the table. No,
right.
That is not how it goes. That is not how scientists conclude that water is H2O.
Right.
Right. The way they actually did it was there's an experiment where you can decompose water into gas. And you know, you can test it, and it turns out to be hydrogen and oxygen gas.
Yeah.
Okay. And then there's another experiment where you can burn hydrogen in the presence of oxygen and it turns into water.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. That's how. Okay. So like there's an observation that couldn't be explained if you have an alternative theory. Like if you think water is NaCl, you could say the same thing about the water stain on the coffee table, but you could not explain the experiment where, you know, the electrolysis experiment where you turn the water into hydrogen and oxygen.
Right. Right.
So anyway, the thing about other people's mental states, like the physicalist needs to come up with some experiment where if other people's brain states constitute mental states, a different thing would happen than what happened if they don't constitute mental states, or if they constitute different mental states from the ones you thought.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and, but it's just like a key part of their view that that's not the case. Like it's part of their view that everything is just explained by the physical properties. If you just gave the correct physical description, that would explain everything.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so great to, it's wild to see that in comparison to epiphenomenalism and see how close and see how they're struggling with the same kind of problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially in light of the problem of other minds. So we got identity theory, and this kind of tracks, actually, I don't know when epiphenomenalism came around. I know like the official story is like behaviorism, then mind-brain identity, and then functionalism. That's kind of how we're taking it in stride here too. But so functionalism, you go over the like two main kinds. There's like analytic functionalism, which is really close to mind-brain, if not the same thing, identity theory. And then there's, I call it machine functionalism because I've read Putnam and stuff. That's kind of where I live, but I don't know, maybe you have a different name, or maybe your taxonomy is different, but would you say those are two functionalisms?
I mean, I don't know. There's like, you know, it's either an analytic or a synthetic view, right?
Oh yeah. Synthetic. Okay, so, I never hear that. Yeah.
So the analytic view is, well, you could just define mental state terms in terms of physical states. Mm-hmm. So, okay. If that's true, like if just the meanings of mental state terms can be given in terms of functional states, then okay, then you solve the problem of other minds, right? Yeah. But like, I think this is too easy. like when you first hear about the problem of other minds, like very few people's response to it is, oh yeah, no, it's just like analytic that if people behave in a certain way in response to certain stimuli, then they have mental states.
Yeah.
Because that's just obviously not true. So that's why we thought there was a problem in the first place.
Right.
But yeah.
Well, one thing you note in the paper, which is true, which is really good. Like one of the motivations, key motivations for functionalism was multiple realizability, where we want to say that there's mentality in other beings. And if there was a, if there was an alien that came down, but he was made of a different material, it wasn't carbon based life form, but like gaseous or something, and still was reasoning and stuff with us, we'd want to say that yes, the there's pain states that are multiply realized that can be realized in this gaseous alien or something. Yeah. But it looks like on the analytic view, I don't know, can they still have multiple realizability?
Oh, well, yeah, so yes, but I mean, so one of the points I make in the paper is, well, there might be like a further kind of multiple realizability that the functionalist didn't notice, which is that a mental state could have different functional profiles.
Mm. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. That was so good. And yeah, so the same state could play a different role in a rattlesnake, I think, than like a mouse versus a human.
Yeah. So you describe some embarrassing experience and it causes embarrassment for a human, but it doesn't embarrass the snake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. But no form of functionalism can accept that. Like, mm-hmm. They have multiple realizability for like physical states. Different physiological states could realize the same functional state, but they don't have different functional states could have the same mental state. Okay, but the other problem for like the analytic functionalist is, well, actually some of the facts about the functional properties of a mental state are empirical. Mm-hmm. Okay, so like, I gave this example that I discovered at some point in my life that pain could be enjoyable. Hmm. So I used to dislike spicy food, but at some point I came to like it.
Yeah.
Before I came to like it, I knew that some people liked it. So anyway,
I'm so glad that you used food and not something else.
That's great. So, it's a weird discovery. Pain can be enjoyable, but true. Okay. So that's an empirical discovery. It's not like conceptual. You don't just think about the meaning of pain and then see that it could be enjoyable. If you just think about pain, you would think that it wasn't, it couldn't be enjoyable.
There's a bifurcation between like analytic and a priori or something. So it's like, maybe a posteriori, I came to understand that pain can be pleasurable in some senses, and that that helped my analytic concept of pain, right? So maybe I just didn't have the actual concept. If the concept included, he's doing an incredulous stare for the listeners. I'm trying to help them out here. Like, what do you make of that? Just because I say, maybe I just didn't understand pain. If I didn't understand that pain can also incorporate some pleasure in there.
Well, I mean, it seems like you could understand it just by feeling some pain, right?
Yeah.
First time you felt pain, you knew what it was. Somebody could say, hey, you want to know what pain is? And then they poke you. That's not more plausible than saying the same thing about anything else that's empirical. And then if you can claim that that's analytic, then you could claim anything's analytic.
Yeah. It might erode the whole concept, which we might even have analytically. What is a pain? What do you think a pain is?
Well, so I don't have a verbal definition of it. I can give ostensive definitions, but you have to be present for me to give them.
Yeah, thanks.
It's this kind of thing that is in common between, and I could list some things like, when you touch a hot stove, and then when you get poked and whatever, and you have a headache, and there's something in common between all those.
Does it incorporate, as a like a dualist, does it incorporate like the ouch of it, like the quality?
Yeah, pain is a type of quale, right?
Yeah. So you can't have an unconscious pain, you think, right?
I don't know.
Neither do I. That's why I was hoping you could help me with that.
Well, my initial reaction is no. So I'm not sure what that means. But then, think about, you can think of cases that are sort of approaching an unconscious pain, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so these sorts of things were like, you're sitting in a room, you're talking about philosophy with somebody for a while, and then at some point, you notice that there's this buzzing coming from the lights in the ceiling.
Yeah.
And at the time that you notice that, you also realize that it's been there for the entire time that you've been there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was sort of like you were unconsciously hearing that.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like there's an unconscious sensation, or it's an unconscious quality, right? Because
yeah,
there's something that it's like to hear it, but you're not paying attention to it.
Yeah, that's like the access consciousness and phenomenal consciousness. I don't know why I feel this way, but it seems to me like you wouldn't be having that sensation then. Like if you weren't aware of it. I don't know. That's weird.
Yeah. There's like, it seems like it's somehow in your mind.
Yeah.
But it's out of the focus of attention.
Yeah. All the global workspace people are freaking out right now. Like, yeah, that's exactly what our theory predicts.
You know, and there could be degrees to which it's in your attention and out of your attention, right? Like,
yeah,
it wasn't completely out of your mind, right? It wasn't completely out of attention because, like, you sort of feel relief when it goes away or something like that. And there would be no reason to try to stop the annoying noise if it was totally out of your attention, right?
Right, right.
And it's sort of like, well, your whole mood improves if you, like, change all of the things that are sort of, like, you're not noticing all the unpleasant things that you're not noticing. If you change all of them, then your mood improves.
That's pretty good. Yeah, that's pretty good. So maybe, and I could ask, like, why did your mood improve? And I have all this third person, you know, information about, I turned off the buzzing noise and stuff. And you're like, oh, I'm not sure. He's like, well, I know why. I like your criticisms of functionalism. It's really good. So you also throw in zombies against them as well, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. So it looks like there could be, it's logically possible, right? So highly unlikely, but logically possible that there could be zombies. So like it could have the same functional characteristics as a person, but it could not have mental states.
Yeah.
I guess that the common functionalist response is no, that's logically impossible. Mm-hmm. Okay, but
yeah.
There's no reason to think that other than that you deduce from your theory that it's got to be logically impossible.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell, like insofar as I have any idea of what's logically possible, like that's a paradigm case of a thing that's logically possible. I don't know.
Yeah.
And if I'm not going to accept that that's logically possible, I don't know why I should think anything. Like, I can't have any beliefs about modality because that's just has the same basis as the rest of my beliefs about modality.
I love that move. I did that in a paper earlier this year where you're like, man, if you don't know this one, then we don't know any of our modal intuitions. That's so much fun. On substance dualism, you'd say like, no, because it's an immaterial soul that does the experiencing, that has the qualia, it is logically impossible. Would you say that zombies are like metaphysically or logically impossible on substance dualism?
Well, no, I mean, it's logically possible to have like a purely physical mechanism that acts the same way as a person.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Right?
It just doesn't have a mind, you know? So.
Yeah, so, but it would be logically impossible to say that a mind is an immaterial substance and this thing has a mind being a fully physical thing, because that's like directly contradictory.
Right. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it? Maybe there's a distinction between logical and metaphysical possibility. Right? It's metaphysically impossible because of what minds are.
Right. Right.
It's not a contradiction because I guess because the mind brain identity theory isn't a contradiction.
But given the theory. It's metaphysically impossible for the substance to us, but like given the theory that like the anti-identity theory that minds and brains are not the same things, it's like, hey, minds and brains are not the same things, and here's something that has a mind which is its physical brain, and you're like, well, no, those two are in direct, you know what I mean, like those are seem directly contradictory. You can't have both of those be true in the same theory or system.
Yeah
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, you could deduce from substance dualism.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, I mean, it's trivially true, or whatever. But it is like, hey, this is one of the theories that doesn't allow for zombies. So, if you think that zombies are impossible for some reason, then come on over.
Well, Well, I mean, you know, it allows for zombies that don't have a mind. So I guess that's the problem.
Yeah. Okay. Would all the other zombies not have a mind then? Like zombies on other views?
I don't know. I mean, you know, they're supposed to be intentional zombies who have intentional states, but no qualia. Is that, I don't actually know if that's possible.
I don't know either. That seems odd. Intentionality because, seems like a, well, I mean, that's one of the arguments you give for substance dualism is intentionality.
Yeah. Like
there is an immaterial mind.
Yeah. But so like, you know, I don't know about that because, well, it kind of seems to me like there is something that it's like to have a belief.
Yeah.
Yes. There's something that's like to believe the P. Well, maybe if it's just an unconscious belief, then there's nothing that it's like, I don't know, but could there be a being that's like all of its beliefs are unconscious? It never, it's not capable of having a conscious belief.
Right.
I'm not sure about that.
I mean, so you might say that's what an AI is, right?
Well,
maybe you're redefining beliefs.
Yeah. I think it may not have beliefs at all. Right.
So yeah.
I think it may be required to have an unconscious belief that you'd be capable of having conscious beliefs. And why? Yeah. I don't know. Because like, you know, maybe it has something to do with what would happen if you did consider the proposition. You know, like maybe you're unconsciously believing that P has something to do with what would happen if you considered whether P consciously.
Yeah.
And that you would accept it or something like that.
Yeah. You're like habituated in a certain way, or like you have a disposition to believe.
Yeah. And so like, you know, the inherently non-conscious being doesn't have any dispositional beliefs.
Yeah. This is awesome. This is good stuff. Okay. I got a couple more for the functionalist. Sorry guys, but that you guys are the ones who are the loudest.
Yeah.
it doesn't actually describe the qualitative feel of a mental state. Maybe we already covered that, but yeah, I guess we did kind of cover that with the voice stuff, but maybe you could run through that again.
Oh yeah, just like, you know, somebody tells you, okay, so, you know, here's a functional profile. Like there's an internal state which is caused by these possible external states, and then it causes these other internal states and it causes this behavior. So now you know what it feels like, right? No.
Right? Yeah.
You know, in Thomas Nagel's famous paper, What's It Like to Be a Bat? He wonders what it's like to be a bat because, you know, they have echolocation. So, you know, you kind of wonder, is it kind of like seeing things in black and white? Or is it kind of like, you know, is it more like hearing, but you're hearing the locations of things and you're hearing the shapes of things or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, we don't know what it's like, but you know, imagine somebody saying, oh, no. We're just going to like figure out the functional properties of the brain state of the bat. And then now you're going to know what it's like.
Yeah.
No, it just doesn't seem like you could know.
Yeah. No, that's such a good one. I really like that critique. There's probably something else with bats that we can play off the mental states having different causal roles. So even if you could like pair these together, which I mean, you have a whole list, but if you did pair them together, it's like, even if you did know what it's like, you wouldn't know. Well, I guess you could observe its behavior, but yeah, it could have a different causal role in this bat than it does for us. And like the embarrassment one is so good. Like something that I may do, me screeching around, trying to do echolocation in like a crowded gymnasium is going to be embarrassing for me, but not for the bat or something.
Yeah. And you know, so it's like, well, you would have certain mental states, you know, and like the bat could have some the same mental states. Like you would have certain perceptions of the other people and whatever, and you have beliefs about the other people and whatever.
Yeah.
And like if the bat has the same perceptions, and I guess, I don't know if it could have the same beliefs, but anyway, if it had the same beliefs about other people, it still wouldn't be embarrassed.
Yeah. I have to ask you this, and I don't think I ever have before, but I usually ask people, I'm kind of surprised I never asked you this, about beliefs in animals. Like, do you think bats have any beliefs? Do you think dogs have beliefs, justified beliefs, knowledge at all?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that dogs know things.
Okay.
You know, like, the dog is chasing a squirrel, and then the squirrel runs up the tree, and then the dog sits there at the bottom of the tree barking at the squirrel.
Yeah.
Why is he barking at the tree?
Yeah.
Well, because he knows that the squirrel is in the tree.
Yeah. Okay. You can help me. you of all people can help me with this. So I went crazy on Donald Davidson stuff, and a little bit too far, and he's
overdosed.
Yeah, big time. So he's like, hey, there's this aspect problem. And so, you know, since we have, because his whole thing was language. You need language in order to have, you need language and concept acquisition coming from other linguistic speakers. And I developed that and ran it for an argument for God, but he would not like that. He's like, there's this aspect problem. You and I can attribute these beliefs or this knowledge to a dog, but he doesn't really have the language sufficient to bring out, to pick out the exact aspect. Like, is he thinking about a squirrel or that brown blotchy thing, that smelly thing, that big chew toy, that, you know, hairy goose? And he's, yeah. And so he's got this aspect problem, and then he's got a holism of the mental problem, where he's like, it looks like in order to attribute those beliefs to the dog, we'd have to attribute other beliefs which seem less probable that he has, like beliefs about trees and squirrels and claws and climbing and maybe the law of identity and stuff. Help me out.
So the dog's belief is not going to be, it's not going to have exactly the content of your belief.
And it won't be English, but is it the same propositional content? Does it have any propositional content, I guess?
Yeah. So, you know, the problem might be that the content of the dog's belief can't be translated into English.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because like all of our words express human concepts. Yeah. That doesn't mean it doesn't have any beliefs, right?
Like, so they're like doggy beliefs.
Yeah. Right. So I suppose the dog has a concept of, it has some concept that is applying to that squirrel. And maybe it's not our concept of a squirrel, right? Because it doesn't have some of the information that we have about squirrels or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, we know that squirrels are mammals. So like, dog doesn't have that. So maybe it's analytic. I don't know. Maybe it's analytic that squirrels are mammals.
Yeah.
So that the dog doesn't have our concept of a squirrel. Because it doesn't know that they're mammals. So,
But
it's got some concept that thing is falling under, I guess. Or, you know, if it doesn't have a concept, then at least it has a representation of that object.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And if concepts just are representations, or if they are like abilities, then it looks like obviously the dog has an ability to pick out squirrels because he's chasing the squirrel instead of the ball or something.
Yeah. It's got representational mental states. Okay.
Yeah.
So, right. Does it have a propositional content? Yes. It's like, okay. So, you know, what's a proposition? It's just like a way that the world could be. So, yeah, there's a way for the world.
Are you a realist about propositions?
I guess, yeah.
Do you think they're like abstract entities?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, they're less.
So do I. This is so good. This is why you're a perfect person to help me. Like, what about like the Benesaraf problem? So it comes from mathematics, where it's like we have a weird epistemology then if either we have weird metaphysics or weird epistemology.
Okay, you've frozen.
Sorry, I lost you there for a second.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, you froze for a second, so I didn't hear that.
Yeah. So I just solved the problem of universals. You missed it. The Benesaraf problem is like, for human beings, how is it that we can come in contact with these causally effete, you know, necessary truths or necessary mathematical facts? And so then it seems like it's even worse for a dog, where it's like, how does the dog pick out a squirrel, like the concept or the abstract object or the proposition, you know?
Yeah.
Seems like a Benesaraf problem for doggies.
I mean, I don't know if the dog has any a priori knowledge. So, you know, might just have knowledge about that particular object.
Yeah.
And where it is. And it might not have abstract knowledge, like whatever, all squirrels are alive or something. Right? Well, I mean, I don't know. So, you know, something that's a priori, okay?
Yeah.
Might not have that because that's supposed to be knowledge of universals.
Yeah.
Anyway, like, oh, okay, how do we have knowledge about abstract objects? Like, I don't know. Okay, so, like, the original formulation of the problem is something like, oh, well, you don't have any causal interaction.
Yeah.
All right, so, you don't have to have causal interaction. Like, this is appealing to an obsolete theory of knowledge, a causal theory of knowledge. It doesn't have to be a causal connection. You know, causal theory of knowledge doesn't account for inductive knowledge either.
Mm.
We're like, you know, the generalization, like that fact doesn't cause your belief because it was only caused by the particular cases.
Or what about like self-knowledge? Like you have knowledge of yourself in a non-causal form, maybe, right?
Oh, I was thinking that it was causal. Like, oh,
okay,
your internal states cause your second order beliefs.
So even when, so if you're reflecting on your own internal states, that's still causal, you think?
Yeah. So like I believe that I'm in pain. Well, the pain caused my belief that I was in pain.
What if you believe that you believe that you're in pain?
Yeah. Then my belief that I was in pain caused my belief that I believe that I'm in pain.
Gotcha.
I guess. Right.
Okay. I don't know. You're the guy, man. That's what I'm asking you.
Yeah. It sounds right.
Okay.
Oh, anyway. Yeah. Okay. Well, so, you know, you need some other theory about knowledge other than the causal theory. I don't know. Okay. Well, you've got justification. You got to have a justified true belief with no defeaters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No genuine defeaters. Right. You know, maybe there's some other stuff, right? Because there are counterexamples to every theory of knowledge. Okay.
But sure.
Anyway, there's no problem with your abstract beliefs being true. There's no problem with your believing them. Okay. What's your justification? Well, I have a great theory of justification. I call it phenomenal conservatism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're justified because certain propositions seem correct to you. Okay. And so then you just have to not have defeaters. Okay. Yeah. So there's no fact out there that when added to your beliefs would result in your no longer being justified in believing the abstract proposition.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good.
And then, yeah, and I mean, it does, it's supposed to do causal work. That's what a lot of like the realists go in, or not explanatory work. It's supposed to do like, you know, resemblance facts for certain things, or, you know, mathematicians are actually studying something. And sometimes they do that and like, well, then there's got to be something out there. That one's kind of weak. But when we turn it over to dogs, like, what do we do with that? Like, it seems, I guess, I don't know. It seems to the dog that the squirrel went up the tree. And if there is a fact of the matter where the dog's sniffing up the wrong tree, then it doesn't count as knowledge because there's a defeater. Does that sound right?
Yeah. You know, say the squirrel jumped to another tree and the dog is still at the first tree, right?
Yeah. I've seen that happen.
Okay, so then he doesn't know. Then he's wrong about something.
Yeah.
But, you know, being wrong means that there's some proposition.
Yeah.
Like if there's something that's right or wrong, then there's a proposition.
Right.
By the way, like many people appear to confuse the adjective conceptual with propositional, right? So like,
yeah,
well, it doesn't have to have a concept, it just has to have a mental representation that can be correct or incorrect.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think you're right. But it seems like they're like really tied together. Like, I guess depending on the theory. So if you think thoughts have propositional content and they're like composed of concepts, then there's still a distinction, but it's like you can't have a thought without concepts and propositions, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you know, depending on what, I don't know, depending on what thought means, that might be true.
Oh yeah, sure.
But you know, like the dog will have some mental state. Like I would be tempted to call it a thought. I don't know if it has concepts. I'm not even really sure what concepts are. Okay. But anyway,
yeah.
You know, like maybe the dog will not have a concept. So, okay. So if you have one of these thoughts that's composed of concepts, mm-hmm. where like you applied a predicate type concept to a subject type concept,
yeah.
Then you have propositional content.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But you can have propositional content without having the thought with the concepts. All right. So like, well, you could just have a perception and your perception can be correct or incorrect. You can misperceive or hallucinate.
Oh yeah. Okay. That's a good point. That's good. That's good. Oh shoot. Okay. So if you're misperceiving, your perceptions have propositional content. Like perception's a mental act? Is it like a mental token? Does it exist like in your mind?
Oh, so there's an experience in your mind known as a perceptual experience.
Yeah.
Right. Perceiving an object requires having a perceptual experience, which is caused in the appropriate non-deviant way by an object that roughly satisfies the content of the experience.
So the content of the perception is an external world object, right?
Well, I take contents to be abstract objects.
Yeah. Okay. So that would be the proposition
that satisfies it.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. And then, so the matching is what makes it true or false.
Yeah. It's a, you know, like some people disagree with this, whatever. Yeah. Some people say perceptual experiences don't have propositional content.
Yeah.
Okay. But like, as far as I understand it, like if a perception can be correct or incorrect, then it has propositional content.
Okay.
Because, you know, propositions are just ways the world might be. They're not necessarily tied to concepts. There could be ways that the world could be that we don't have concepts for.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I like it. So we're diving, double dipping down on dogs here. Dogs, yeah. Wait, did you say that dogs have beliefs? They have knowledge, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't, they have something belief-like and something knowledge-like, right?
Do those have, I mean, those have to have intentionality then, right? Like if the dog has something about, so you gave this argument for souls from intentionality. Does that mean that dogs have souls?
Yes. Yeah.
Nice. All right.
Anything with a mind.
Okay.
Right? A mind is a soul. So it's...
Yeah. A mind is. Okay.
And like, as far as I can conceive, you know, you have to have a soul to have any mental states at all. Like there can't be a mental state without a subject that experiences it.
So yeah, I'm with you. I totally agree. Some of my Catholic philosopher friends are going to be like, a mind is not a soul. A soul is composed of all these inseparable parts, and a mind is one of them. It's like, yeah, okay, guys, but for this conversation, we're talking about immaterial things. And I don't know. Have you considered that like there's different parts to a soul, and the mind may be one, or you have like an intellect as well, or is that like medieval nonsense?
I don't know. It sounds nonsensical. I mean, they might just be using the word soul in a different sense, right?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Because there's this, you know, Aristotelian notion of a soul where there's like plants have a vegetative soul.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I've been getting into some consciousness stuff, science of consciousness stuff, and on the science side, people go in for some odd stuff. Like they will go really externalist and be like, hey, a plant has a belief about the sun, and so it turns that way. And I don't know what to do with that kind of stuff, man. That just seems so bonkers. Like that a tree could have knowledge. Like you have to have on your view, like you have to have a soul to have knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You have to have a soul to have a belief. You have to have a belief to have knowledge. So yeah. Yeah. Okay. Why should we not think that plants have beliefs? You know, this is connected to the problem of other minds, right? Like, how do we know that plants are not just mindless automata? The answer is they are. I guess I would say, okay, the hypothesis that plants believe things doesn't help us to explain anything that, you know, that we can't explain otherwise. So, I believe there's an explanation for phototropism. Which is, you know, when the plant turns towards the sun.
Yeah.
And I believe that explanation is chemical and physical, and you don't need beliefs to explain why that's happening.
Yeah. If the plant said, hey, how's it going today? It's a nice day for sun. I'm going to turn this way. Then you'd have some kind of phenomenal facts to explain. And that's why there's this disanalogy between humans and the problem of other minds and plants, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And by the way, like, you know, even if you like the argument from analogy, it's like, well, we have brains, and when we have beliefs, they are realized by our brain states. The plant doesn't have a brain. So like, I didn't even know what the theory is about how it has beliefs.
Yeah. There's this vegan, I know you're a vegan actually, so I'm safe. You're a vegan, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Mostly. So we're safe. There's this vegan who's been commenting on my stuff, and they might, I'm just trying to preempt that they're going to say like, well, they do have a brain. You're just being, you know, human centric or something.
Well, I mean, I would think that because, you know, vegans are for eating plants. I would think that they would be making the distinction between
saying plants. No, that they don't. So otherwise they can't eat anything. Unless they do it in a humane way and doesn't cause pain or something. Or,
yeah, maybe plants are intentional zombies, right? Maybe they have beliefs, but they don't have qualia.
Oh,
so
yeah, sure. That's good. Yeah, that's great. So I want to go to AI eventually. I'm probably going to title this something AI to get people to click. So they're probably going to be upset that it took us this long. But we talked about some AI in there already. Here's one thing that a lot of AI engineers or AI theorists, probably the engineers probably don't talk about this, but the theorists will say they'll go with the problem of other minds and say, hey, look, someone says, how would we know if this machine's conscious or not? And they go, look, you can't even prove that I'm conscious. Like, there's this problem of other minds. So if I can't prove demonstrably or, you know, depending, they're probably not getting into the epistemology of fallibilism or infallibilism, but they're saying, like, if I can't prove that you have a mind, why should I have to prove that this robot has a mind? If it behaves as if it has a mind, you know, why can't I do this? And so you're going to say, because I can explain it with other non-mental things, like the design plan or something of the engineer. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So, like, a favorite argument for computer consciousness is something like, well, like, the only evidence that I have that other people are conscious is that they behave as if they're conscious. Mm. And so if a computer behaves as if it's conscious, I have the same reason for thinking that it has mental states. And so so I should attribute mental states, provided that it can pass the Turing test or something like that.
Yeah, right.
Right. So my response is, okay, so there is an initial reason. So if they, like, you run into a robot and it behaves like a person, behaves as if it had consciousness, there's some initial reason to ascribe mental states to it. Unfortunately, though, there is a defeater for this, you know, in most cases, which is that, you know, that the reason why it behaves that way is that somebody went through a very complicated, long, painstaking process to deliberately make it act as if it had mental states.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, right. So it's sort of like, you know, if you see an image that looks exactly like a picture of the Statue of Liberty, you think, there probably is an object like that and somebody took a photograph of it. Okay. But suppose that actually you saw somebody making this and they were actually painting it on a piece of paper and they're just like such an incredibly good artist that it looks like a photograph. Okay. Well, then that defeats your reason for thinking that there was a real object.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that's sort of like the case of the AI, right?
Yeah.
If you didn't know that somebody made it and, like, deliberately designed it to act as if it was conscious, then you would think that it was conscious.
Yeah. So a lot of times, Susan Schneider is a philosopher who's deep into the AI world.
And that's right. My former grad school colleague.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
That's awesome, man. I didn't know that.
Co-student. Yeah.
That's at the same time. You guys were both studying at the same time.
Yep. Wow. At Rutgers. Yeah.
Dang, that's so good. Holy cow, man.
Did you interview her?
Yeah. Now we're friends. Yeah, she's great. Okay, good. I forgot who her dissertation Fodor. Yeah. Did you have Fodor as well?
So I was advised by Peter Klein because I was writing about skepticism.
Yeah. But did you take any grads?
Oh, I took a class from him. Yeah.
Nice. I think she told me that she gave him an actual heart attack in her thesis defense, or in her PhD dissertation defense.
Wow.
Which is pretty wild.
That's impressive.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, that's you have a really good argument. Like, there's this passage where Robert Nozick talks about coercive arguments, trying to force people to agree with you. Yeah. And he says, like, the best argument would be one where if you don't accept the conclusion, you die.
So she got really close.
Yeah.
Wow, that's wild. She pulling from, like, Philip K. Dick stuff, she comes up with these consciousness tests. And she's like, hey, these only work if you don't train your AI with consciousness language of what it's like and how it feels to be a conscious being. Do you think there's anything to that? So, like, if you could see, like, the white paper, I forgot what they call these things, but they come out with a paper saying, like, here's our AI and here's what it's like. And they say, like, we explicitly did not use any consciousness language. And yet here it is talking in ways, not using those words, but in ways that are picking out the same kind of experiences that we say are qualitative experiences. Would you have more reason to think that one's conscious than the one that's been trained on?
Maybe. Now, you know, this makes me want to read the actual things, like what it actually said.
Yeah.
And also, like, what it was trained on. But yeah. I mean, like, you know, my understanding is that they train these things on huge quantities of data where, like, it's not really possible for us to review all of the data that was trained on.
Yeah. And I guess it depends on the type. I'm learning all this stuff now. It's insane. But yeah, there's, like, feet forward ones, and like the ChatGPT models is like, well, no, obviously not. And you've been trained on the whole internet. But maybe there's other ones that has, like, more recursive style learning. and hasn't been trained. So Ben Gertzel wants to, he's like, hey, I need to, we need to have, make a baby AI and then train it through interaction, through like a human in the loop the whole time. Like here, I'm going to show you stuff. I'm going to teach you concepts just like we do with children. If you did, if you did it that way, I don't know. What do you make of that? Would you think like maybe there's something here?
Well, so like the more similar it gets to a person, the more likely it is that it could be conscious.
Okay.
So like my view isn't that it's impossible to artificially create consciousness.
Okay.
It's just that it doesn't automatically happen just because you got the behavior right.
Right. Totally.
So now what do you have to do to make consciousness? So I don't know, because I don't know why we're conscious in the first place.
Yeah.
Then you have to duplicate whatever it is that caused us to have consciousness.
Yeah.
Which is something about the brain, but I don't know what it was. So it might be that you have to have the actual chemicals, right? The actual same materials, but, or it might not, I don't know.
Yeah. I always wonder what counts as artificial. Because if you just make like an isomorph of the human brain, some people are like, that's not artificial intelligence. Like, well, they did it in a different way. You know, it didn't follow. I guess if you like 3D print a sperm cell and an egg cell, like that has no chain in the human race, like it, that seems kind of artificial, right? But you're just reproducing what biology has done.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that sense, yes, you can, there could be an artificial intelligence, right? There could be an artificially created being that was conscious.
Yeah.
Like, because if it was physically identical, it had the same physical characteristics as a person with a brain, then it would have consciousness. But like, that's not the controversy, right? I think the controversy is whether you could create an artificial conscious being that's made of completely different materials, right? Like silicon.
Yeah. So earlier we were talking about psychophysical laws, and I'm wondering, I used to go in real strongly on like Searle's Chinese Room and Ned Block's Chinese Nation and say, look, machine functionalism must be true in order for AI to be true. And it obviously is not true, or it ascribes mentality to things that are obviously not conscious. So that's silly. But then I had some of my substance dualist friends say like, hey, if you think that there are psychophysical laws, then why couldn't they hack those laws and have mentality and things that are not biologically similar to us? Do you think they could hack the psychophysical laws and produce consciousness in a non-organic substrate?
Right. What do you mean by hacking the laws?
Yeah. So like usually the laws produce mentality in something like us, but I don't know, you create a different situation wherein those laws are realized, but not in the normal way.
Yeah. So like, if we figure out what the psychophysical laws are, then we can use that knowledge to create conscious beings artificially.
Yeah.
But it's an open question whether a being made out of silicon could sustain consciousness, right? So, because we don't know what the laws are. They may require an object made of actually the same materials as us.
Yeah. What do you think about that? Do you think that, to me, it's like, I don't know. I've seen some Star Trek. I know you like Star Trek, and it's like, well, I don't know. It seems like the biology stuff, the chemical stuff doesn't, why would it be that, you know, why would it be these right chemicals? It could end up being that way, but to me, it seems like that would be surprising. I don't know. I just want to get your intuitions on that.
I don't know. It doesn't sound surprising to me. I don't know.
There would be chemicals.
You know, the stuff we're made of is pretty important to us, I guess. You know, Searle sometimes gives these examples like, you know, I could run a computer simulation of digestion.
Yeah. But
it, no matter how good the simulation is, it will not digest any food.
Yeah. Yeah.
You Bernardo Kastrup. The computer.
Yeah. Bernardo Kastrup always says something like that, where it's like, yeah, I could simulate water on my desk, but my desk wouldn't be wet. And so, yeah, same exact thing.
I don't know.
It's tricky, man. The whole thing's tricky. Well, I just think as a substance dualist, it seems like, especially because you go in for like you know, eternal souls that like they didn't have a beginning. It seems like the physical isn't as important. Maybe you could just say, yeah, it is. They just can never attach to anything else. But really, what's doing all the work is the immaterial, you know, soul. Doesn't
So, you know, there's there's a bunch of immaterial souls that exist. And I was going to say are out there, but they're not out there because they have no location. So there are some immaterial souls. I don't know how many. I don't know if it's finitely or infinitely many. But anyway, and periodically one of them becomes embodied.
Yeah.
And how does that happen? I don't know. You get the right physical configuration of some physical object. Okay. And we know that human brains have the right configuration, but we don't know what else does. We don't know how wide the range is.
Yeah.
Of configurations of particles. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so like the right kind of physical object comes along and it starts causing states in one of the immaterial objects, the immaterial souls. And then the states of the immaterial soul also then cause effects on that brain or that physical object. It's like, well, the immaterial mind is supposed to do something because it's supposed to affect your brain and therefore your body.
Yeah.
But also it doesn't do anything by itself because like it has to have experiences caused by physical states of your brain. Right. So like, you know, when you're disembodied, I assume you don't have any mental states. And so then.
I don't know. There's this near death experience literature. And I don't know. Like if I've never read like a bunch of it, but I'm like, if everyone, I'd have to have some error theory, which maybe it's out there for thinking that every single one of those is completely false.
Yeah.
But in lieu of that, like then I'm like, or not in lieu, but if I don't have that, then it's like, well, it looks like someone is having a conscious experience outside of embodiment. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, like a long time ago, I tried to learn about this and I was like, okay, so what would be really important? What would be really impressive would be if somebody during a near-death experience had information, acquired information by perception.
Yeah, right.
That they had no other way of acquiring.
Yeah.
And then they should be able to report that to people after they're revived. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I couldn't find a convincing case of that. So like I found a case where people claimed that happened and then it was debunked by skeptics.
Okay.
And then I guess, you know, I found the skeptics credible.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I don't know, some big NDE person will probably like hear this and say,
that's right. Yeah. Drop it in the comments, folks. Let's hear it. Yeah.
But anyway, like, okay. With a lot of things like this, there are a lot of amazing claims that are like this, where somebody tells you some empirical facts that if true are like really compelling evidence for some paranormal phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then somebody else comes in, debunks them. Okay. And then the first person goes, well, you debunked like 10 of these, but there's like a few that you didn't succeed in debunking. So then, and I think that happens a fair amount. And then how should you react? And then like my reaction is, well, because they succeed in debunking most of them, probably they're all bogus.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like an inductive kind of inference. Okay. I don't want to stick too long on the NDEs. Someone, you know, drop them in there. We like the interaction anyways. Let's hear about it. I know someone's going to talk about someone seeing a number on top of a refrigerator or whatever in an operating room. That's great. Drop them. I want to hear them. So I'm wondering about, so there's something about the physical brain that gets the soul to like latch onto it or interact with it. If you made a brain that was like 300 times the size of a human brain, you 3D printed it or something, and it had a soul attached to it, maybe there's more computing space. Maybe it's the same thing as us. It's just really big and like it hates itself because it's so gigantic. But maybe, you know, maybe there's more computing
power. It's a fat brain.
Yeah, right. Like self-conscious about it. But maybe you add more folds or something and it's smarter than us. Would that count as super intelligent artificial intelligence?
Oh yeah. So it could be super intelligent. I mean, like, this isn't exactly what people mean by artificial intelligence, technically it's intelligent and it's artificial. So I guess you could say, right. But that's not really what people are talking about, but okay. Yeah. So now, can you create such a thing and it would actually be alive and super intelligent? I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But I mean, there might be limits. Like it might be if you make it too big, then it dies or something.
Yeah, right.
I wouldn't be shocked by that happening.
I know. I'm thinking because then it would be like, well, why this exact size? You know, because you shrink it down. Maybe you have I can't use any words because that'd be offensive. But you shrink it down and you have a little mini version of a brain, or you, you know, magnify it. And if there's some, I don't know, maybe there's an argument for theism here, from like the instead of the cosmological constants, like the exact perfect parameters for the human brain to be, receiving soul.
There are much smaller brains, right, in the other animals.
That is true.
And they function, obviously, so. But, you know, and there are a little bit larger brains, like, I guess, elephants or whales.
Yeah, like a blue whale, I'm sure, is probably pretty huge brain.
I assume. Okay, but, you know, whether there could be one 300 times larger, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have no reason for thinking that it would die, but I wouldn't be shocked if that would happen, because, yeah. I don't know, biology is like that.
Yeah. Okay, last thing. This is kind of weird, but if there are a limited number of immortal souls that have never came into being but just always have existed, if we continue on, you know, another 100,000 years, maybe we make it to Mars, and now there's like 7 billion people. If there's only six... Wait, sorry, there's like 8 billion people. Let's say there's 16 billion people in 100,000 years from now. Yeah. And there's only 15 billion souls.
Yeah.
Like, what, you know, what happens is, like, are those zombies, you think? Or they're just stillborns? Or?
So some of the souls would have to be reused.
Right? Okay.
Okay, but so I assume that the number is very large.
Right? Okay.
So the number of souls is very large, such that you wouldn't expect, okay, I don't know, this is kind of ad hoc, but anyway, so you wouldn't expect a soul to have to be reused. But, okay, so, you know, this is where my view about the mind starts to sound like weird paranormal stuff. But if you if you used up all of the minds, then you have to reuse a soul, which would mean that there would be a mind that had two bodies. There'd be somebody who had the experience of having two bodies.
At once? Or are you talking about just reincarnation?
Yeah, at the same time, right? So, like, if the current population of the world is larger than the number of souls that exist, right? Then there have to be some souls that have, like, two bodies. And so, like, that person should experience being in two places at once. So they should see two different scenes, simultaneously have two visual fields where different stuff is happening.
Yeah.
And then they're walking, okay. And so if this happened, it looks to me like there would be amazing empirical predictions of that, right?
Yeah.
So like that person would be able to violate special relativity, because like their two bodies could be in two separate locations, and then it looks like they could have superluminal communication.
Yeah.
So like the one body could do something that would take into account information that was given to the other body.
Yeah, that's like the best case scenario. The worst would be like just overlapping fields that you just can't, interpret anything, right?
Yeah, it might be very confusing.
Yeah.
But, you know, given that you have two brains, you'd probably have double the information processing capacity. So you'd probably be able to handle it somehow.
Yeah. Well, unless like the phenomenologists are right about the unified phenomenal consciousness, that it's like one per person. But maybe they're not right about that.
Yeah, by the way, like I feel nervous about this, because like, you know, this is like an amazing empirical prediction, which I'm sure.
And not amazing in like a great way.
To happen.
Yeah. Yeah. But if it does happen, yeah, then that's like really, you have empirical evidence for your theoretical. Yeah,
that's true.
Postulates. Yeah.
Right. Although, the theory is kind of unfalsifiable, because although there's that possibility that would support the theory, if that never happens, it could just be that there's infinitely many souls.
Right.
So,
yeah. Or just one more than we ever get to, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It could always just be a larger number. Although, well, the thing is, like, say there's, 20 billion souls and the population is 8 billion. Okay, well, but if we continue for like a few centuries, we should just expect sometimes just by chance there to be a soul that occupies two bodies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, unless there's some rigid rule going on in the universe that's orchestrating things. That makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, maybe it's just like souls that are presently disembodied are always a better candidate for connecting to a new brain.
Right. Yeah. There's some kind of, it's easier to do that than the others. So even though it's not impossible, still it just never comes up. Yeah, that's good. Well, we went all over the place. This is so good. I really appreciate it. Thanks for helping me and disabusing me of certain Davidsonian views. I still got to chew on them some more, but this is awesome, man. I appreciate what you do so much. For my audience, that's great. You know, all that stuff too, but just for me personally, like I've learned a bunch from you. So I really appreciate it.
Oh yeah. It's great to be here. And you know, I appreciate being invited because it's
yeah, fun. Definitely. So I have the background, Thanos taking the Mind Stone out of Vision from Infinity War. And I did that for you because I think you're kind of like Thanos taking the mind out of the machines. You guys don't get to have these. So that's the background for all the folks who were watching.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah. All right, that's going to have to do it for now, folks. This has been Parker's Pensies, and as always, all glory to God.